This evening, on behalf of Harvard Bookstore, I'm very pleased to welcome Atul Gawande for a discussion of his latest book, The Checklist Manifesto, How to Get Things Right. 2 years ago, Dr. Gawande published an article entitled The Checklist in The New Yorker. The article explored the success and the simplicity of a checklist employed by a critical care specialist at Johns Hopkins Hospital. The article was received with surprise, fascination, and much attention. And I know that I was thrilled when I heard that Dr. Gawande would further explore the idea in his latest book. The Checklist Manifesto, How to Get Things Right, investigates how even in the complex world of surgery, a simple 90-second variant has cut the rate of fatalities by more than a third in some hospitals. Dr. Gawande then applies the device to scores of other professions and situations, from restaurants to investment analysis and beyond. Looking at Dr. Gawande's current job listings, I am very grateful that he has found the time to join us tonight. A general and endocrine surgeon and a writer, Dr. Gawande is a staff member at Brigham and Women's Hospital and the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. He is associate professor of surgery at Harvard Medical School, associate professor in the Department of Health and Policy and Management at Harvard School of Public Health, and research director of the BWH Center for Surgery and Public Health. He is also the director of the World Health Organization's Global Challenge for Safer Surgical Care. So as you can tell, he has ample free time, and in it, Dr. Gawande has published topically wide-ranging research studies, served as a senior health policy advisor in the Clinton administration, is known for his elegantly written and eloquently conceived articles for The New Yorker, where he's been writing for over a decade, and has also authored and edited several best-selling books, including Complications and Better. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us this evening. Thank you for your patience. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Atul Gawande.
Thank you, everyone, for joining me and for coming out this afternoon. A pleasure to be here also at the Brattle Theater, one of my favorite places to be. And I want to try to explain why the heck I would write an a whole book about something as unsexy as checklists. In order to try to explain this, I'm going to start with a case and then take us through what I think that case means for us in healthcare, and then potentially what it means for even beyond. The case is a case I read a while ago. It was a 1999 report in a surgical journal, and it was it laid out the way you should treat drowning patients. And they had been able to enumerate the steps along the way in a case that arose involving a three-year-old girl. This was in a small Austrian town called Klagenfurt. And as the report explained, it all started when a family was out on a picnic and then lost sight of their daughter. The next thing you knew, they looked out and saw that she'd fallen into a icy fish pond. And then the next thing after that, her head had gone under the water. The parents jumped in frantically. This is everyone's nightmare. And did not find her. It was a solid 30 minutes until they finally could feel her there on the pond bottom, pull her up to the surface, get her to the shore, and then found that she wasn't breathing. After at least half an hour underwater, she looked for all the world to be dead and gone. They called the equivalent of 911, and the emergency system operator walk them through how you do CPR for a little girl like that. And so they started doing chest compressions. A rescue team arrived 8 minutes later, and they were the first ones to take vital signs at the scene. The girl had a temperature of 66 degrees, more than 30 degrees below normal. She had no pulse and no heart rate. And most ominously, her pupils were dilated and did not react to light, meaning that the brain was essentially gone. There was no reaction there at all. But no one gives up on a little girl, and they continued the chest compressions. They transported her by helicopter to a hospital where she was transferred. They bypassed the emergency room and went directly to the operating room. She was then put on a cardiopulmonary bypass machine. And that's not a small matter. In order to get that girl onto bypass, you have to open up the vessels overlying the groin, expose the femoral artery and vein, plug in inflow and outflow lines to your cardiac pump, prime the pump, and then get it going with blood flow to replace the heart of hers that wasn't working. This takes time. And by the time the pump was finally working, it had been 2 hours from the time she had gone under that surface. They gradually warmed her blood. If you go too fast, you can burst the blood cells. And after 2 hours, they were able to get her temperature up 10 degrees. And at that point was the first time you started to have a heartbeat. Her heart started to come back. It was in a normal rhythm. And so they continued the warming process, continuing to raise it so that over the next 6 hours, they were able to bring her temperature to 98.6 degrees normal. At that point, they wanted to then try to see if they could get her lungs working. They had a tube going down her throat, and they pushed air through the tube, trying to drive oxygen into her lungs. But it turned out that the lungs were too waterlogged and filled with debris from the pond, and it wasn't possible to get air across through the alveoli to exchange oxygen for carbon dioxide. And so they needed to try something different. The cardiopulmonary bypass machine is built for temporary bypass for cardiac operations. And so they brought in a system that's something like an artificial lung called an extracorporeal membrane oxygenator. To plug this in, they had to do a sternotomy. So they saw it open her chest, exposed her heart, and then plugged the inflow and outflow lines into the right atrium of her heart and into her aorta. Then you can unplug the other machine. You have to repair the vessels in the groin, close up that wound. And then finally pull a sterile drape over all the tubes and lines, leaving her chest open, and transport her on a bed with this artificial lung down to the intensive care unit. They were able to safely do that, and then worked on her for the next 24 hours, suctioning out her lungs, cleaning out the debris with bronchoscopy and other maneuvers. And after 24 hours, when they tried again to put her on the mechanical ventilator, they found they had been successful and now could get oxygen across the lining of her lung and carbon dioxide back. So at this point, they now have to unplug the ECMO machine on the mechanical ventilator. So down she goes again to the operating room. They take out the tubes and lines. They repair the holes in the heart and in the aorta, and then close the chest. Watching her in the intensive care unit for the next 48 hours, they then walked through the steps for returning the liver to normal function. Her liver had been in shock. Her kidneys had shut down, but gradually came back. They even were able to get her digestive system functioning and give her food down a tube into her stomach. And gradually they found every organ came back, but one, her brain. So now she had stabilized enough that they felt safe taking her down to radiology and did a scan of her head. Her brain, they found, had swelled to the limits of her skull, but there were no dead zones, no areas where there had been a stroke from the loss of oxygen. And so they thought, maybe there is still a chance that she could come back. So they tried one more thing. They called up the neurosurgeons, who came down and drilled a hole in her skull to relieve the pressure that the brain was under and to place a probe into the brain to measure the pressures it was under. And then they dialed their fluids and their medications up and down to level out the pressures in order to see if that brain would recover. For another week, she was completely comatose. And then slowly, she came back to life. First, her pupils started to react. Then she began to breathe on her own. And then one day, she just awoke. She was there. A week later, she was able to go home. Now, it wasn't over. Her right arm was paralyzed. Her right leg was paralyzed. Her speech was slurred. She required 2 years of neurological, occupational, and physical therapy in order to see what functions could be regained. And then at the 2-year point, she came back to the clinic for a full battery of testing, including neurological and psychological function. And what they found now for this little girl at age 5 was that she was perfectly normal, like any other little girl that you and I know, with normal strength, both sides of her body, normal speech, and normal developmental ability and educational ability. I thought of that, the story, it struck me, because it seemed incredibly revealing. First of all, we had the science at this point to even bring back a little girl who had drowned and gone without oxygen for at least 30 minutes, in reality more like 2 hours. And yet, we were able to rescue her. But the second thing was reading through that article and seeing exactly what was done was flabbergasting. You wondered, how did they pull this off in this hospital in Australia? And they never tell you that. They just say, there's this, there's this, there's this, there's this. But what it told you was it's nothing like it is on Grey's Anatomy. This wasn't just a few chest compressions and this little girl would come coughing and sputtering back to life. It was hundreds of steps, one right after the other. It had to be executed the right way, without an error. Just think, if someone hadn't washed their hands and an infection had gotten under that drape covering her open chest, it would have been over. Just one little slip like that. And here you had dozens of personnel having to walk through multiple steps over and over again. At this moment of health reform, where we're close to passage of a bill to provide coverage to people, you can imagine that the hardest struggles in medicine have to do with the money issues, or the insurance hassles, or the bureaucracies of government regulation, or the fears of malpractice lawsuits. None of those things make the job any easier, but they are not the hardest part of what it is for clinicians to do. The deepest struggle is instead one that virtually every profession now faces. It's how we deal with the increasing complexity of what our jobs require. One of my favorite essays is by Samuel Gorovitz and Alistair MacIntyre, two philosophers who wrote an essay on the nature of human fallibility. And what they point out is that there are two sources of failure in anything we try to do as human beings. One was ignorance. Science hasn't given us all the knowledge of every way in which the world works. And so we can err because we just don't know. But the second they called ineptitude, meaning the knowledge is there, but an individual or a group of individuals fail to apply that knowledge correctly. What is fascinating about the moment we've arrived in for our particular generation is that ineptitude is now the modern struggle. Ignorance was our problem, was the major reason we failed at what we set out to do as human beings for almost millennia. We didn't understand the reasons that we become ill or what to do about it. We didn't understand how to deal with nature and its many challenges around us. We didn't know all the answers for how to deal with food and how to supply it to ourselves. Come now to where we are at the turn of this century, and things have changed considerably. We now have identified, because of discoveries of this last century, 13,600 different diagnoses that afflict the human body. We've enumerated that there are 13,600 different ways that our bodies can fail. And for each of them, we have been able to generate beneficial treatments. Not cures all the time, but for virtually all conditions, steps in care that can contribute to people having less suffering, less misery, potentially more productive life, even in the, and in many situations, actual cures. And so what do we have? We have 6,000 drugs. We have 4,000 medical and surgical procedures we've designed. And the job of medicine is to try to deploy these town by town across our entire country, if not the entire world, to the people that need them in the right way, at the right time, in the right place. There is no industry that has to deliver 13,600 service lines town by town like that. And I think, in a sense, we have been fooled by penicillin. When it was discovered in 1929, and then we learned how to put it into mass production by the end of World War II, what was miraculous about it was not just the fact that it seemed that we could cure a disease that had many diseases, many infectious diseases, that we thought were incurable before. That alone was amazing. But then further, it was just this injection, and that was all it took. The idea that this is all that medicine would require raised the vision for ourselves that maybe for cardiac disease, we'll only need an injection, or maybe for cancer, that's all we'll need is an injection. But instead, I think the metaphor is a place in medicine that looks much, much more like our little drowning girl. In order to handle all that we have to unfold in order to take care of people, we've then turned to a series of steps, tactics, to try to tackle it. And our major tactics have been technology and super specialization. 13,600 diagnoses? Okay, I can't handle that. So let's divide it up. Have one group of people who handles 40 or 50 of these, and someone else who handles 40 or 50 of those. You have a right knee surgeon and a left knee surgeon. We would be able to have the mastery of super specialists to make sure that we have figured out how to deliver on the knowledge that exists. And we found it hasn't been enough. Even after all of the training, all of the technology that's proliferated, you see failures everywhere. Some of it's in our simplest steps. 2 million people picking up infections in hospitals, most of them because somebody didn't wash their hands. And 100,000 of those patients die from those complications. Look at coronary artery disease, and we find 40% of patients with that disease coming into the hospital receive incomplete or inappropriate care for their illness. 60% of pneumonia patients receive incomplete or inappropriate care. And then you look wider, 36% increase in lawsuits in the last 3 years for legal mistakes, lawsuits against lawyers themselves, most commonly for administrative errors like calendar date errors and clerical screw-ups, as well as errors in applying the law. And then you see we have flawed software design, foreign intelligence failures, tottering banks. These are the problems of ineptitude, not of ignorance. These kinds of failures are registering an emotional valence. They are, I think, the source of our country's growing disgust for the elites, people like me. We have tolerance for leaders who grapple with the ignorance of the world and fail sometimes. We just didn't know. But we have intolerance for ineptitude. What do you mean someone didn't wash their hands? What do you mean someone screwed up the calendar date for my court papers? What do you mean there were 3 pieces of information that could have caught that terrorist and kept them from being on that plane that he nearly brought down with his with the underwear bomber. There's a reason that philosophers gave these kinds of failures such a pitiless word as ineptitude. Now, I never thought I would be writing a book about checklists, but we had to grapple with this problem of ineptitude in surgery, in a project that I did for the World Health Organization with some of my team who are here. And when we did, we were tackling the question of risk and complexity and how we ensure that we avoid deaths. It was a project asking, can we find a way to reduce deaths in surgery globally? And why? As people have lived longer around the world, as we've gotten a better handle on infectious disease and economic conditions have improved even despite this recession, we've reached a point where people are surviving their initial infectious diseases and developing all the regular kinds of problems that we run into in industrialized societies. So the result was that we're now doing more than 230 million major operations for problems like cancer and road traffic accidents and congenital birth defects and other problems. One operation for every 25 human beings on Earth. In the United States, we're doing some 50 million operations a year, one for every six people. And in the United States, we also see that although we have gotten better and better at being able to master providing surgery safely, we're getting often seemingly remarkable results. But you do that much surgery, and you better be getting doing following through on all of these steps really consistently. And what we find is we're not. 150,000 plus die each year following surgery. And we know from our studies that at least half of those deaths are avoidable. There are missed antibiotics resulting in infections that are our most common source of major complications. You can have bleeding disasters and difficulties with resuscitation. You can have the wrong patient, the wrong side of the body operated on, bad teamwork. And so we had to ask, what do we do about ineptitude when our usual approaches, just train and train and train more, could we possibly train even further for more years? I went through 8 years of training in surgery and was finally glad to reach the point of saying, I don't think we want to make the solution more training. Could it be more technology? We started to feel that although technology can be a savior, in many instances it may be increasing our difficulties as much as helping with them. And so we had to look beyond medicine to other industries. And what we found is that all over, they're struggling with the problems of ineptitude as well. But we looked in some, and they were actually finding solutions. Areas like the aviation world, skyscraper construction, where you see, you rarely see, in fact, you almost have never seen skyscrapers falling down for failures in construction or design along the way. And so as we tried to look and see, and as I tried to unfold through the book, how it is that skyscrapers are going up in Boston and being as consistently designed as they are, you would find a common answer in fields grappling with this kind of extreme complexity. They had a recognition that, number one, our brains are flawed, and therefore, number two, we need a checklist of all things. There is resistance to this idea, and they found it when they began trying this kind of low-tech approach. And the resistance comes from the fact that experts we see ourselves as people who have trained and trained for the whole reason that you want to avoid checklists. What were all those years of training about other than to say, I know what I'm doing? Checklists are for low-status people. They are about dumbing things down. You can't reduce the complexity of taking care of patients, of building a skyscraper, of flying an airplane, to a checklist. And yet they found that they did have to resort to even experts picking up checklists on airplanes, because the planes had become so complex that they were beyond what their brains could handle. They forgot things. They overlooked steps. They had troubles with teamwork. And so we stole the ideas into medicine. It first entered the ICU world with work that a Johns Hopkins researcher began trying a simple five-step checklist for central lines. The intravenous lines that go into ICU patients were commonly becoming infected about 5% of the time, resulting in death rates that resulting in high death rates, because these are some of our sickest patients. And when he applied a checklist just asking that the nurse and the physician check on themselves to say, have we got gloves on? Have we got a hat, mask, glove, and gown? Have we got a sterile drape over the patient? Have we sterilized the site with antiseptic appropriately? Have we put a sterile dressing on afterwards? They found they were missing one of those steps at least 30% of the time, and the checklist was catching it. And the result was that in the state of Michigan, when it was adopted, a 2/3 reduction in infections throughout the state. A savings of 1,500 lives in the first year it was applied. A savings of $200 million. But that's for a simple kind of procedure. What about procedures that may have hundreds of steps? What about something like surgery? We worked with Boeing to try to give it a try. And Boeing is a fascinating place. I wrote a chapter about visiting their checklist factory, a place where they have over 100 checklists a year generated, all in an effort to be able to make it actually useful for pilots, highly trained people, in a situation where they may be going into a crash, only have 2 minutes to react, and the last thing on the world you would think they'd want to pull out is a piece of paper and start reading it. But they'd actually been able to think about the difference between good checklists and bad, and how you actually aid people under stressful conditions and make it possible to have that be the most useful thing that they would want to do, is to pull this out. And so we learned from them, you have to keep them short, make them too long, people become distracted, which forces you to prioritize and focus on killer items. It also means you don't enumerate every single thing you have to do. We therefore focus down to just 19 critical items that surgical teams would check before putting the patient to sleep, before making the incision, and then some final checks before they leave the operating room. And we focused on some of it, just the dumb stuff. Make sure an antibiotic was given. Make sure blood is available before you start an operation that might have heavy blood loss. And then it also had some interesting steps. Because you couldn't spell out all the steps in an operation, you have to have a team that can adapt to what comes. There is no recipe for many situations. Instead, the checklist suggested we designed suggested something interesting. Make sure everybody in the room knows each other's name, because having a team that's ready to handle a situation turned out to depend, from studies outside of medicine, on such simple factors as, if you're going to start a committee meeting, what do? You go around the room and make sure everyone's been introduced. And our teams are now so large and full of different people that engaging people to have a chance to just say their name in a room turned out to be recognized to cause what's called an activation phenomena. They're much more likely to speak up later. The medical student who feels they have no place in the room now has a chance to say, I'm so-and-so, the medical student. And they then suddenly feel part of the team. Also, the team briefs one another, the surgeon going through, how much blood loss should we expect? What is it the team should know about equipment and special considerations? The anesthesiologist reviews their plans and concerns. The nurse is made sure to have a chance to review their concerns and plans for the operation. And only then would they proceed. It's the idea of preparing for the unexpected. We weren't sure that this would at all work. And so We tested it. We tried it in 8 hospitals as part of this project with the World Health Organization, and since it was with the WHO, we tried it in hospitals around the world and deliberately in places that really ranged in settings, from some of the best hospitals in the industrialized world, University of Washington in Seattle, University of Toronto, St. Mary's Hospital in London, hospital in Auckland, New Zealand, to places like a hospital that was the lone hospital for a district of almost 1 million people in rural Tanzania, busy hospital in New Delhi, in Amman, Jordan, in Manila, in the Philippines. We asked the teams to try their best to incorporate this checklist into their routines for what they did in every operation. And after 8,000 patients, we reported the results in the New England Journal of Medicine last January. And what we found was that in every hospital, they achieved at least a double-digit reduction in their complications. Each hospital had managed to have reductions in complications, and the average reduction in complications was 35%. There were 27 fewer deaths in the group that got the checklist, a 46% reduction in deaths. This is designed, we hoped, to be transmissible, simple enough to move around the world. And so by the end of the year, more than 2,000 hospitals had adopted the checklist as a standard of care. 20 countries had incorporated into their standards of care. 1 month ago, France went live with it in all 8,000 of their operating rooms. Places that had healthcare systems that were universal seemed to be able to do this more easily than we have. We're at about 20% of our hospitals that have been able to adopt this. We're getting there. But there's resistance to this idea. It runs against our whole idea, as I said, of being an expert. When we started the checklist in these institutions, the staff were understandably skeptical. Come on, the last thing we need is a piece of paperwork. And I certainly didn't look forward to the idea of yet another step in care unless we showed something that would really prove useful. When we surveyed the team, we asked them, did you actually find that this was better in any way? And 80% reported that, in fact, they had noticed that it had saved people from errors. They thought it improved teamwork and communication. They thought it was easy to use. But one of the fascinating things to me was the flip side of the numbers. 20% hated it, thought it was pointless. I'm good at what I do. Why in the world do I need a checklist? I was probably one of those people. I began to use the checklist in my operating rooms about a year ago, or a little more than a year ago, about 2 years ago. Not because I thought we needed it in my operating rooms. We're introducing them in Tanzania and Toronto and Seattle. Did we really need them at Harvard? We've been working hard for a long time on making ourselves the place to have surgery in the country. But from the first week I implemented the checklist, I was shocked to find we were catching errors. And I have yet to get through a week in surgery where it has not caught. The antibiotic hadn't been given. Blood hadn't been available. Or the most unexpected things, going around and having that conversation, you'd have a nurse say, I'm sure we've taken care of this, but tell me again, what was our plan for this patient's breathing problems? And I'd say, what breathing problems? She'd have some problems with obstructive pulmonary disease, and I'd say, how is it possible that I didn't know that? But then we would prepare for it. And they would say, well, the last couple operations she ended up in intensive care because of how bad her lungs are. But then we prepared for it. We gave her inhalers ahead of time. We were able to think about all the steps we could deploy to try to prevent it from happening. There was no guarantee that things wouldn't have been a real problem for her. But then by doing so, she was actually able to not only recover without needing the intensive care unit, she actually went home from her surgery that night, something that didn't even seem conceivable to that point. I've even seen it save my a patient's life. I think we have walked into a situation where we're struggling with the complexity of what we do, and we've imagined what it takes is more and more training, more and more expertise, and it does. We can't walk away from the need for technology. We can't walk away from the need for training. But we also can't walk away from the reality that our brains are limited. We're fallible, even as experts. And as a simple tool, the checklist is lowly, it is humble, it is overlooked, and it is misunderstood. But when we pay attention to how they work, how they fill in for our weaknesses, what you find is that they can be transformative. It is, I think, almost a basic cultural principle in how we deal with overwhelming complexity in the modern work world. We must recognize first that we will fail, that the knowledge of the world has exceeded our individual capabilities, and then ask what we will do about that and prepare. It involves a different idea of ourselves as people, I think, and as experts trying to do work in the world. It is something that requires us almost to rethink heroism. One of the fascinating processes to watch was the experience of people responding to the miracle on the Hudson when Captain Sully Sullenberger landed that plane, that jet that was hit by geese that took down its two engines with 155 people on board, and he managed to save them, landing on the water of the Hudson River, and all of us staring in amazement, thinking what a hero he was. But then none of us seemed willing to listen to what he really was saying. We'd say, Captain Sullenberger, Sully, tell us about that training you had as a teenager and then in the Air Force Academy flying gliders. That must have been the critical skill that really saved those people on that plane that day. And he'd say, no, actually it wasn't. Flight ability had almost nothing to do with it. I actually had a computer on the plane that was helping guide it down to the water. And we'd say, he's just being modest. And he kept saying, what saved us was adherence to discipline. What saved us was teamwork. But it was as if we couldn't process what he was trying to tell us. The steps of what happened on that flight, when you really walk through it, involved, first of all, the person next to him that you hardly ever heard anything about, Jeffrey Skiles, his co-pilot. And they had never met before that day that they got in that plane. There was a critical moment that saved that flight, and it happened long before they even took off. It was the moment when they walked through their checklists. They first introduced themselves to one another because they hadn't met before. They then walked through some basic checks, making sure the equipment and everything was ready. And then they asked themselves a series of questions, including, what do we do if the engines fail? Now think about this. These were both pilots who'd had more than 25 years of experience flying each. They had never had the engines fail on them before. They expected to retire from their careers never having had the engines fail on them ever. And yet, they still walked through those checks. They had the discipline, the self-discipline, to make sure they did. And so then, when they got up over Manhattan and those geese hit the jets, and when they found themselves in a situation where they had 3.5 minutes to be able to handle all that was going on, they had already put themselves in a position to handle it, to know what to expect from one another. Immediately, they knew Skiles would start working to restart the engines, because the single most life-saving maneuver would be to get at least one of the engines restarted. And so he started walking through those checks. He also walked through the checks to get the flaps out to make sure that it would be in the right position for a water landing. And because they each went through their checks, Sully could rise above all the dumb stuff. He didn't have to think about all of those things and could focus on the one key decision for which human judgment was required. Where am I going to put this plane down? And he could focus and pick the right thing to do. The heroic part of that flight was not the flight ability of Captain Sullenberger. It was the willingness of the entire team, including the flight attendants, who then acted through their protocols to get the passengers off of that plane in 3 minutes before it could go underwater. It was their willingness to first acknowledge their fallibility, that they could fail just relying on their memory and training alone, and then that they could exercise the discipline to overcome it. And that's what's rare. That's what's hard to hold on to. I want to finish by reading a little bit from the from a moment where, having read that report about the drowning girl, the puzzle in my mind was, how did they actually walk through all of those steps that they had to do? They'd recognized the theory of what needed to be done, but this was a small hospital. The Klagenfurt Hospital is a community hospital, not the kind of mecca that we try to be at the Brigham and Women's Hospital or other places around the world. And they never spelled out how, so I called up the lead author, Marcus Thalmann, who turned out to be a young cardiac surgeon who'd been on staff there for 6 years. Dr. Thalmann told me he'd been working in Klagenfurt for 6 years when the girl came in. She had not been the first person whom he and his colleagues had tried to revive from cardiac arrest after hypothermia and suffocation. His hospital received between 3 and 5 such patients a year, he estimated, mostly avalanche victims, some of them drowning victims, and a few of them people attempting suicide by taking a drug overdose and then wandering out into the snowy alpine forests to fall unconscious. For a long time, he said, no matter how hard the hospital's medical staff tried, they had no survivors. Most of the victims had been without a pulse and oxygen for too long when they were found, but some, he was convinced, still had a flicker of viability in them. Yet he and his colleagues had always failed to sustain it. He took a close look at the case records. Preparation, he determined, was the chief difficulty. Trauma surgeons, a cardiac anesthesia, success required having an array of people and equipment at the ready. Trauma surgeons, a cardiac anesthesiologist, a cardiothoracic surgeon, bioengineering support staff, a cardiac perfusionist, operating and critical care nurses, intensivists. Almost routinely, someone or something was missing. He tried the usual surgical approach to remedy this, yelling at everyone to get their act together. But still, they had no saves. So he and a couple of colleagues decided to try something new. They made a checklist. They gave the checklist to people, the people with the least power in the whole process, the rescue squads and the hospital telephone operator, and walked them through the details. In cases like these, the checklist said, rescue teams were to tell the hospital to prepare for possible cardiac bypass and rewarming. They were to call when possible, even before they arrived on the scene, as the preparation time could be significant. The telephone operator would then work down a list of people to notify, to have everything set up and standing by, and to go through their own checks. With this checklist process in place, the team then finally had its first success: the rescue of the 3-year-old girl. Not long after, Thalmann left to take a job at a hospital in Vienna. The team, however, has since had at least 2 other such rescues, he said. In one case, a man had been found frozen and pulseless after a suicide attempt. In another, a mother and her 16-year-old daughter were in an accident that sent them and their car through a guardrail, over a cliff, and into a mountain river. The mother died on impact. the daughter, was trapped as the car rapidly filled with icy water. She had been in cardiac and respiratory arrest for a prolonged period of time when the rescue team arrived. From that point onward, though, everything moved like clockwork. By the time the rescue team got to her and began CPR, the hospital had been notified. The transport team delivered her in minutes. The surgical team took her straight to the operating room and crashed her onto heart-lung bypass. One step followed right after the other, and because of the speed with which they did, she had a chance. As the girl's body slowly rewarmed, her heart came back. In the ICU, a mechanical ventilator, fluids, and intravenous drugs kept her going while the rest of her body recovered. The next day, the doctors were able to remove her lines and tubes. And the day after that, she was sitting up in bed, ready to go home. Thank you. Should we legislate checklists? And I'll try to repeat these. Thank you for reminding me. Part of the idea here is all we really want professionals to do is lay out what they think are the key steps that should happen and then ask themselves, have we done it? And have I made sure that it's happened? There actually was a bill filed in the Massachusetts legislature after our surgery checklist came out a year ago, saying that it should be almost illegal not to use this checklist. But a couple of things about it. Number one, every place should adapt and create their own checklist. And a checklist is not just a piece of paper that you drop into someone's operating room or office or anything that we do. It is an aid that should be designed so that experts can get better at what they're doing. And that means they adapt it and change it. When we had it go into each of the 8 hospitals, they had to change the flow and the design to make it work in each of their facilities. And then many of them added other components. They said, as long as we're doing this, let's see what else we want to make sure we take care of. Further, the way it works in the aviation world, the FAA regulates and demands that airlines use a checklist, but they don't actually specify what that checklist should be. Boeing and Airbus then design the checklist, and then the fascinating thing is that even those checklists are not necessarily the ones that are used by US Air and United and all of those others. They adapt it to their own culture and their ways of going about things. One of the things I didn't surprise me to learn is that when two airlines merge, one of the fiercest fights is between the pilots' unions over which checklists they're actually going to use. And so I think what we have to do is, in a sense, mandate that these be part of the way we think of ourselves. But we almost have to start on as a cultural change level. We have to teach that, we teach medical students and residents that you have a tremendous amount of knowledge to get into your heads about physiology and anatomy and everything else that you have to know, all the pharmaceuticals, their side effects, and so on. We will teach people that in a certain situation, you have to be ready to have that information, but we don't teach them that there will be a moment when you don't have that information, where it will fall through the cracks, and you will harm someone because of it. And so you'd better well be prepared for it. Pilots can't even go anywhere near the plane until they have been taught and inculcated that number one, they're going to fail, they're going to forget something, and if they don't have a check process in place to take care of it, they will kill people, including themselves. And these, I think, are the first key steps for getting us forward. I said we have 13,000 diagnoses. The kind of work we're doing with surgical checklists should only be the beginning. We need the checks for the HIV patient, for the patient with a depression, so that when you're in the office with the doctor, they're not embarrassed. They don't see it as a sign of weakness to say, well, this is what I think we should do, but I want to just go through my checks to make sure I haven't missed anything. I think it would give us confidence in our professionals rather than weaken our strength of faith in them. When we have not taken this approach of saying, when it comes to social policy, what are the common reasons that social policy fails? And one of the reasons is that we often pass well-intentioned legislation without having that legislation designed so that implementation can actually work. Either you decided, well, let's save a little money on the front end and not actually give any funding for the agency to organize it, or let's insist that that they have deployed it within 30 days after the law passes, and suddenly you see an incredible scramble. When we passed the Medicare prescription drug plan to provide insurance coverage to the elderly for the drugs that, they take, because implementation wasn't thought about and the way that the package was designed, you suddenly had this a public health emergency in the majority of states in the country because the systems just couldn't work for allowing the elderly to have insurance coverage. They would arrive on January 1 and suddenly find they couldn't get their prescriptions filled. You had diabetics who couldn't get insulin. There was almost no question people died because we didn't get those steps right. There does, in fact, just as you say, need to be a kind of checklist in place that comes from this understanding that we need to recognize we have failures. They occur constantly. They come in patterns. There are costs to them. And we have approaches like a lowly checklist that, if we have the discipline to run through it, can save us from major disaster. Her dad flew for American Airlines, and they use checklists all the time at home. Yes, I torture my poor family up front here when we talk about whether they have checked their homework lists. This is fundamentally important, actually. One of the fascinating things to me is that as we have watched how situations of complexity unfold, not just in medicine, but in Katrina, for example, and who were the people who were able to actually rescue people, it wasn't what we call the first responders. The real first responders are often the bystanders and the people on the scene dealing with the complexity of what's there. Who was it that was able to be the last stop to rescue that terrorist on the plane but a fellow passenger? And in including people as part of the team, in medicine as well, is going to be what we have to do. One of the fascinating things is that as we have looked at what is required to, say, prevent pneumonias in patients who are in bed for a long time in intensive care units, one of the steps is to keep the bed up at 45 degrees, but you have to put the bed down at times to change the patient's position, to turn them, and so on, and then put the bed up again. And having the checks in place for just the nursing and the doctor teams would get you up to 80 or 85% success. But when you added the patient's families into the checklist and said, by the way, can you go ahead and tell us if we haven't washed our hands, or if you notice that your family member's bed is not up at 45 degrees, only then were they able to get to 100%. I want to thank everybody for the chance to come out and to be here.